Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, Nick Champeau here, and a warm welcome to the program coming up.
It is unacceptable that supply or transit countries interrupt the flow of energy without prior consultation.
The EU unveils ambitious energy plans as a recent standoff with Russia highlights Europe's dependence on Moscow. We'll have reports from Brussels and Berlin. 16 years after the fall of the Iron Curtain, the communist past continues to haunt former members of the Eastern Bloc. This week, it forced Poland's archbishop to resign. And victims of the 1999 beach massacre in Congo-Brazzaville will finally see justice thanks to French courts.
The main principle is when national justice is unwilling or unable to prosecute or to investigate, there should be a way for victims to find another forum.
And tourism off the dirt roads of Romania's mountains. These stories and more in this week's Network Europe. But first, to our main story. The European Commission unveiled an ambitious energy package this week in a bid to combat climate change and reduce Europe's dependency on foreign energy sources. The move came just days after Russia turned off the taps on a key pipeline running through Belarus to the Czech Republic, Germany, Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia. Moscow finally resumed oil supplies to Europe on Wednesday, but this new standoff with Russia's President Vladimir Putin highlights once more the urgent need for Europe to diversify its energy resources. Deutsche Welle's Nina Maria Potts has more.
The European Commission unveiled its wide-ranging energy package by taking a cold, hard look at the facts. World temperatures have risen over the last 11 years. The European Union's energy dependency on foreign supplies could jump from 50% of total energy consumption to 65% in 2030. And oil prices have risen sixfold in the last 7 years. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said recent power blackouts and disputes between Russia and its near neighbours have forced EU citizens to recognise the need to diversify supply sources.
We need new policies to face a new reality. Policies which maintain Europe's competitiveness, protect our environment, and make our energy supplies more secure. Europe must lead the world into a new, or maybe one should say, post-industrial revolution, the development of a low-carbon economy.
The European Commission has set ambitious targets to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2020 and called on all developed countries to do the same. But the Commission's plans to overhaul Europe's internal energy sector presents an equally daunting task. José Manuel Barroso said Europe's gas and electricity markets are simply not performing well enough. An extensive review shows European energy companies are not transparent enough, not competitive enough, and not coordinated enough. The European Commission has unveiled some radical new approaches in the name of competitiveness, including something called ownership unbundling, which would involve splitting energy companies between their different activities. For this to work, all national governments would have to start breaking up energy monopolies so there can be much more cross-border competition, a much greater coordination between national energy sectors.
It is about a better deal for consumers. This is about making the market work for the sake of citizens.
The European Commission also pointed the finger firmly at Russia for acting irresponsibly by cutting off oil supplies to Belarus. Despite a last-minute deal, the European Commission says it should be able to guarantee energy supplies to member states.
It is unacceptable that supply or transit countries interrupt the flow of energy to the countries that are consuming the energy without prior consultation. This raises a problem, a real problem of credibility.
Credibility comes, argues the Commission, from a common energy policy and Europe's ability to speak with one voice to third countries. But there are huge internal differences to overcome first. For example, the highly controversial use of nuclear energy to generate electricity. In areas like these, says the Commission, it will not interfere with individual countries' choices over their energy mix. Brussels will simply present the facts and let member states weigh up the pros and cons. So the Commission's energy package is ambitious, to say the least. The real question now is, who will sign up to it?
And thanks to Deutsche Welle's Nina Maria Potts for that report. Along with José Manuel Barroso, German Chancellor Angela Merkel also said Vladimir Putin should have consulted the EU before turning off the taps. She went further, actually, because she accused Russia of betraying Germany's trust. Now, Germany and Russia have signed bilateral energy deals, so dealing with Moscow as both German Chancellor and rotating President of the EU is a bit like walking a tightrope for Merkel. Our EU insider, Stephen Castle, met the German Chancellor this week, and he's on the line from Berlin. Stephen, unlike her predecessor, Merkel seems to be quite determined to confront Putin, despite her country's deals with Russia, because she said that Moscow had destroyed confidence.
Well, certainly the language, the rhetoric from Mrs. Merkel was surprisingly tough. I mean, as you say, she talked about destroying trust, undermining Russia's credibility as an energy partner. And I think really what it illustrates is the fact that although, as you say, Germany has this close relationship on energy with Russia, it's, for example, got this pipeline project with Russia under the Baltic Sea, much to the annoyance of the Poles, because this, of course, cuts Poland out of the action. So while Germany has this privileged relationship with Russia, even Germany is not immune from the effects of what President Putin's doing with his energy policy, the way in which he is flexing his muscle and really taking a rather aggressive stance over the whole energy issue.
And energy is a top priority of Angela Merkel's six-term mandate as a EU president, and she was also talking as EU president. Do you think that the crisis will end up encouraging member states to commit themselves to a genuine common energy policy? Because the energy package is there. It was unveiled this week, but it requires commitment.
Well, it does indeed. And I think there is an argument that actually this whole crisis between Russia and Belarus has been rather good for the EU, because it certainly has concentrated minds. You know, in one sense, you can look at this as a crisis. In another sense, you can look at it as an opportunity, particularly for the European Commission, which could go out, launch its package and say to the member states, look, this objective that we've set of diversifying our sources of energy, doing it in a carbon neutral way, trying to reduce emissions, trying to liberalize markets, this agenda has never been as relevant as it has been now. And if you doubt us, just look to these, just look what the Russians are doing, just look at the consequences of being completely reliant on this one energy superpower for your gas and oil.
But that will require time. In the meantime, Putin, it seems, can go on flexing his muscles. Because, for instance, as far as Belarus is concerned, he obtained what he wanted at the end of the day, because Belarus has agreed to lift its demand for transfer fees.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, in the short term, there is no doubt that the Russians hold most of the cards. Europe is very, very dependent on oil and gas imports from Russia. And at the moment, there really is very little in terms of alternative. The danger for the Russians, I suppose, in the medium to long term, is that they overplay their hand. Because, as I say, this has given an impetus to the European energy policy. Governments across the whole of the EU, all the 27 member states, are now thinking very hard about energy policy. And they are addressing issues which they really weren't even a few months ago, such as whether to return to a nuclear program. Now, in the short term, as I say, President Putin holds most of the cards. In the long term, it's possible that he could have overplayed his hand, particularly if the EU gets its act together.
Network Europe's e-insider Stephen Castle reporting from Berlin. Well, as Stephen said, Poland was also concerned over the oil issue, but another event which has nothing to do with oil shocked the nation this week, and that is the resignation of the newly appointed Archbishop of Warsaw, Stanisław Wiergus. He resigned 2 days after he admitted that he'd collaborated with the Communist Secret Services and only hours before his formal investiture ceremony. His resignation is no doubt one of the most important events in the history of the Polish Church. Michał Kubicki from the Polish Radio External Service reports from Warsaw.
It is clear to Poles that the Catholic Church, which played a highly significant role in the defense of human rights during the communist period, was not perfect. What has shaken the majority of Polish Catholics and the nation at large, therefore, was not so much the fact that Archbishop Wiergus collaborated with the communist secret services, but that he repeatedly lied about his past. According to a prominent writer on religious affairs in Central Europe, Jonathan Laxmore, the latest events are a reflection of a crisis. The Church looks quite compromised in a moral sense, and many people in Poland feel a great deal of bitterness and confusion.
My sense is that it's going to be difficult for people in the church by themselves to settle these problems, which is why I suspect that it may be necessary for the Vatican perhaps to send a visitation to Poland or something of that kind, basically to establish what has happened and why, and to identify the kind of changes that need to be made within the church, which are perhaps long overdue in some cases.
The last-minute resignation of Archbishop Wiergus met with mixed reactions of the faithful.
The church commission ruled that he was an agent, so the final decision was correct.
It would not be good if such a high office be taken by a person with such a strongly tarnished character.
I'm sorry for him as a person. It's a pity that he hadn't revealed the truth earlier.
There were also those who yelled, "Stay with us," as the Archbishop was reading out his resignation. And it is to these voices of disapproval that Father Alfred Wierzbicki of the Catholic University of Lublin referred to in his assessment of the current crisis.
I am convinced that this crisis opens us to new solutions. I accepted the decision of Archbishop Wiergus to resign as the best solution, and this reaction of the Holy Father was also expected, I would say, by the majority of the Polish Catholics. Even if we heard some voices of disapproval, now this is a chance to build a church in the truth, and it enables the witness of the church to the gospel, to the moral values.
According to most analysts, the situation within the Polish church is very complex because everyone seems to be taking sides, and it might be difficult to find people of authority who would play the role of mediators. Despite this, Jonathan Laxmore says that there is hope that the crisis will have a cleansing effect.
I think that the great hope now will be that this crisis has really brought all of these latent sort of festering tensions and sort of resentments and bitternesses out into the open once and for all. And I do sense that there have to be changes. There may have to be personnel changes at the top of the church. I don't think that the Polish society is going to desert the church or desert the faith. Absolutely not. I think Poles have always made a very sensible distinction between the Catholic faith, which the average Pole is very much committed to, and respect for and the willingness to sort of follow the lead of the Catholic hierarchy.
The Polish Church has every reason to be proud of its overall record under communist rule. The recent events will surely lead to a public debate in Poland, not only how it should deal with the dark sides of its recent history, but also on the way decisions are taken within the Bishops' Conference now.
Polish External Radio Service reporter Michał Kubicki. You're listening to Network Europe. Still to come, rural tourism in central Romania. And Sweden celebrates the 300th anniversary of the birth of natural scientist Carl von Linné. But first, to France. Congolese victims can now take their Congolese torturers to court in France. This week, the French Supreme Court overturned a stay on the case of the disappeared of the beach. In 1999, 350 refugees returning home to Brazzaville in the Republic of Congo were taken away by public authorities and disappeared. Families of the victims, along with two survivors, started proceedings in French courts against some of the Congolese officials involved. The French Supreme Court's decision to allow the investigation to continue affirms the concept of universal jurisdiction. This means that for crimes involving torture, individuals can file a case in a foreign country for crimes committed abroad. Radio France International's Sarah Elzis reports from Paris.
Marcel Tuanga says that justice has been done.
Nous avons maintenant la certitude que il y a une justice qui existe quand même dans le monde.
We know now that there's justice in the world, says Tuanga, whose 28-year-old son disappeared the night of May 14, 1999, in Congo, Brazzaville. He later found out that his son had been shot by public officials, along with dozens of other young men, who were returning from neighboring Kinshasa, where they had taken refuge from the civil war in their own country. The 300 victims are called the Disappeared of the Beach, because they came through the Brazzaville River port called the Beach.
Là, c'est la joie. Au fond de moi, au fond du cœur, vraiment c'est la joie que justice soit faite correctement.
It's a joy that justice is going to be done correctly, says this man, who was one of two survivors of the killing.
La balle était rentrée sous l'oreille.
The bullet entered under his ear and came out through his mouth. He shows the scar above his lip.
Les gencives.
The bullet ripped out his gums, but didn't kill him. He managed to drag himself from under the bodies and escape. He eventually made his way to France, where he joined with Marcel Tuanga, who represents the families of the victims, and another survivor, to look for justice.
Based on the principle of universal jurisdiction, for crimes of torture, you can file a case in France, even though the crime was committed abroad.
Jeanne Sulver is a lawyer with the International Federation for Human Rights, which prepared the case along with other human rights groups in France and Congo. The initial investigations led to the indictment of two Congolese officials, including the director of the police. Sulver explains that cases like these can be filed in any country that has ratified the Torture Convention. France incorporated the convention into its criminal code in 1994.
So since 1994, any alleged crime of torture committed anywhere in the world, as soon as the person is present on the French territory, the French courts have jurisdiction. So on that basis, we brought a case on behalf of the victims in France, based on the fact that one of the alleged perpetrator had his home and house in France. He was living in France. So we brought this case, and once the investigation was ongoing, the diplomatic and political relationship between France and Congo became very tense and sensitive.
The organizations representing the victims have denounced political interference in this case, which led to one defendant escaping from a Paris jail in the middle of the night in 2004. But the Supreme Court's decision put an end to any political meddling by saying that the case can go forward.
The main principle is when national justice is unwilling or unable to prosecute or to investigate, there should be a way for victims to find another forum.
15 officials were tried in Brazzaville Criminal Court in August 2005, but they were all acquitted. Sulver says that applying universal jurisdiction, using foreign courts to find justice, began in earnest in 1998 when the Chilean general Augusto Pinochet was arrested in England and faced charges there and in Spain.
Since 1998, there's been a very regular and progressive use of the mechanism of universal jurisdiction. There's this idea that any court should be able to prosecute torture, war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide anywhere in the world.
The International Criminal Court is not retroactive, so it couldn't hear the Brazzaville Beach case because the events happened before 2002. The European Court for Human Rights only hears cases against governments, and this is a case against individuals. So the lawyers got a bit creative in figuring out who could be prosecuted on French soil, though this isn't the first such case.
There's ongoing, maybe something like 15 cases in France involving perpetrators, torture in Algeria, Cambodia, in Rwanda, but there's also a number of cases ongoing in Europe.
Now that the French courts have agreed to allow the case of the disappeared of the beach to continue, the lawyers and victims will get back to work on the investigation, but at least it's going forward. This victim says he's waiting for the day of the trial and the final victory.
Ma satisfaction sera totale le jour du procès à la victoire finale. J'attends que ça, quoi.
And thanks to RFI's Sarah Elzis for that report. You're listening to Network Europe. These days you have to be prepared to torture your car on Romania's countryside dirt roads if you're looking for the proverbial untainted Romanian hospitality. Well, Radio Romania International's Julian Morsan made that sacrifice for Network Europe, and he found this report from somewhere in the Carpathian Mountains in central Romania.
Mr. Fasan's cabin is situated at an altitude of 1,100 meters. It's not easily accessible, and the fact that the only form of advertising for his business is through word of mouth doesn't bother him at all. He doesn't have a website, but he has what he calls a book of honor, a guest book which looks like a multi-language glossary of words of praise. With unconcealed pride, he tells me about the important guests he's had in recent years.
1 year and a half, my son got married, and we had all sorts of guests here. Among them, there were two Americans. One said he was the president of the Olympic Committee in Washington, and the other one a music professor. They were really impressed with what they saw here. They went to the kitchen to see how we prepare the food and everything. When they left, they told us they would have never believed there is such a place in Romania.
Indeed, Mr. Fasan has reasons to be proud. The location and the surroundings are superb, and he's done a wonderful job here. He's producing his own electricity, and he has central heating running on wood. The only thing he buys when he goes into town is juice and beer. The rest comes from his own household. He breeds chicken, swine, and even trout. Those who enjoy his hospitality once are bound to return. Adrian is here for the third time.
Why should someone come here? What can they find?
Just a wonderful forest. Nature, quiet, everything.
The main attraction of the area is a gigantic fir tree not far from Mr. Fasan's cabin. We had quite a good laugh trying to climb the steep slope to the 500-year-old fir tree. Coming back from the short trip, we feel the welcoming smell of wood fire. Besides the grill, soon to be populated by all sorts of meat, I catch up with Miwara, a distant relative of Mr. Fasan, who helps him with the cooking. When I told her that I'm working for an international radio station, she started crying.
Oh my God, my children will hear me, and my grandchildren. I have a grandchild in America, in California, and a son in Spain. I can't even pronounce the name of the town where he lives. And I have a daughter in Germany, in Munich. They're all gone.
I tried to persuade Miwara that in 10 years they will all be back. I don't think she really believed me, but a glimmer of hope in her eyes I did catch. After all, I was coming from Bucharest and I was supposed to know things. While waiting for the trout to be grilled, I start a conversation with Mr. Fasan about European Union and the funds that Romania is supposed to receive in the coming years. My interlocutor may look like a shepherd from Gura Râului, or Boca del Rio as he likes to call his native village near Sibiu, but he is a convinced liberal and he knows quite a lot.
We have so many problems in our village and we are trying to access European funds through different programs. But the people with ideas must elaborate projects. For projects, they need consultants. But the consultants, they want the money first, immediately. That's impossible. I can pay the consultant, but only after I receive the funding and I have my project up and running. That's why many people are disappointed about these funds and especially about the consultants.
Mr. Fasan says he's going to build his own hotel in Gura Râului without European money. Judging by what he's achieved so far, I tend to believe him. People like him are turning rural tourism into the winning card of Romanian tourism, while, for instance, the huge sums pumped by the government in promoting the Black Sea coast seem to have gone down the drain. Last summer we saw that most foreign and Romanian tourists chose Bulgaria's coastline for their holidays. Well, in Mr. Fasan's guestbook, one can also read Bulgarian.
Radio Romania International's Julian Morsan. Now to Sweden. 2007 marks a very special anniversary in Sweden, And it's an event that the country will be celebrating on many levels, both in Sweden and abroad. Radio Sweden's Juan Navas filed this story.
Carl Linnaeus, Carlos Linnaeus, Carl von Linnea, and sometimes just Carl Linnea. No matter which way you say it, Carl was a man who greatly influenced Sweden and the world. He was born on a farm on May 23, 1707, in the province of Småland. Today, Carl von Linnea is known as the man that laid the foundation for the modern scheme of nomenclature, a method of assigning unique names. But he's also considered one of the fathers of modern ecology and known as the father of modern taxonomy. Now the country is getting ready to celebrate him in many different ways, from the cultural to the scientific. The year 2007 is the year of Linnea. I spoke with Anders Björk, the county governor of Uppsala County and a chairman of Linnea 2007, to find out why Linnea is being honored 300 years after his birth.
Because he is one of the most famous natural scientists in history. He had a revolutionary impact on natural science, especially flowers, but also on other aspects here. And he is also the most well-known Swede, both in Sweden, of course, but also abroad. So that's why we are going to celebrate the 300th anniversary of his birth and using this to encourage, for example, young people to study natural science, but also encourage governments and private enterprises, etc., to give money to natural research.
And how will we celebrate 2007 then? What's going on?
Oh, there will be a lot of events, films, books, scientific seminars, but also, of course, a lot of exhibitions. There is still a lot of his personal belongings in Sweden, and they will go abroad. There will be a lot of other activities. For example, the Swedish king and queen will go abroad on a state visit to Japan to meet the emperor and empress. And there will be a special Linnaeus exhibition in Tokyo. The emperor and empress will take part in the jubilee in Sweden. We will, for example, have an 18th century Linnaeus garden at the Chelsea Flower Show in May in London, and so on and so on.
What do you think is the most important thing people can get from this celebration, then?
I think the most important thing is that the great discoveries is not behind us. It's in front of us. There is still fantastic things to develop, and to find, etc. And we can make a comparison with the Swedish astronaut, Mr. Fuglesang. He was out into space just before Christmas. And Linnea would have liked that, exploring new areas in the world and outside our own planet.
Anders Björk, the county governor of Uppsala County and a chairman of Linnea 2007.
Thanks to Radio Sweden's Juan Navas for that interview. And that's almost all we have time for on this week's edition of Network Europe. Don't forget our quiz. This month, we'd like you to tell us the name of the country which joined the Eurogroup on the 1st of January. Euro notes and coins are now being used in 13 countries. The address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. And please visit our website, www.networkeurope.org, www.networkeurope.org. If you want to hear more original features about Europe or podcast our program. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, for me, Nick Champeau in Paris, it's goodbye. We'll leave you with Carla Bruni and her new single, Those Dances Days Are Gone. Bye-bye.
Come, let me sing into your ear. Those dancing days are gone. All the silk and satin gear. Crouch upon a stone, wrapping that foul body up in a foul rag. I carry the sun in golden cup, the moon in a silver bag. I carry the sun in golden cup, the moon in a silver bag. Curse. as you may, I sing it true. What not a written name that the most could pleasure you. The children that he gave, some were sleeping like a dump. The mom, the fly gay, carry the sun in golden cup. The moon in a silver bag, I carry the sun in golden cup. The moon in a silver bag. Come, let me sing into your ear.
Da-di-da-di's very day, noon upon the clock.
All that silk and satin gear.
And then they put pretense away, who lends upon a stick.
Sing and sing until he drop. What a tomato hag, I carry the sun in golden cup. The moon in a silver bag, I carry the sun in golden cup. The moon in a silver bag. Come, let me sing into your ear. Those dancing days have come. The silk and satin gear crept upon a stone. Wrapping that foul body up in as far.